A rare Friday day edition of the Dunktown Basketball Podcast. Wanted to let our stuff earlier in the week marinate a little bit. We had the awards podcast that we did yesterday, if you want to go back and listen to that. Also, the Twitter NBA show postgame might be a little out of date at this point, so don't bother listening to that anymore.
It's still excellent.
Yeah, if you want to get an idea of, I guess there's like some good like mailbag question stuff at the end that's probably worth that. That's a little bit more evergreen than usual. I'm rambling now. We're doing a mailbag here. We got some big news to get to first, though. Sponsors today, Movement Watches, mvmtwatches.com. You can get 15% off your watch order just in time for the holidays. And Indochino. Use that cap space code to get any premium Indochino suit for just $389. 50% off the regular price for a made-to-measure premium suit. The demo thing, is it over now? Like, this is like the eighth episode that we've done this now. Are we done here?
Yeah, we're done, but I think we should have a conversation about whether the deal that it looks like they agreed to is better than the one that he walked away from.
Yeah, and by the way, Danny is a little bit hoarse, so I'm going to continue saying completely ridiculous things throughout the show that require him to unexpectedly interject.
Talk with the officials?
Yeah, we actually, the software that we use to record, you can like put in what your name is. Like, I sent Danny a link, and so his name for himself today was Horse Like Doc. It's actually pretty good. I should just say things that would be ridiculous to Austin or to Austin Rivers to Doc Rivers. Many of them involving Austin Rivers, probably. All right, let's get to this demo thing. What happened was, for a refresher, the deal got matched by the Rockets. The original deal had a guaranteed date in January for the remaining $3 million or so of this year's salary, which was going to be about $9 million. It also had a March 1st guarantee date to guarantee next year's salary. That was unpalatable to the Rockets. They wanted to wait until July to do that. The other aspect that was unpalatable is that any restricted free agent offer sheet match, you now cannot trade the player for 1 year without his consent. And he cannot be traded to Brooklyn at all during that period. So all of that was not palatable to the Rockets. Then what was not palatable to Demo about the situation, which it seems like he probably didn't realize, was that the Nets offer actually was worth more than the Rockets offer. Usually you would want to do it the other way around, where they're going to be worth the same, but there were some incentives in the Nets contract, such as workout bonuses, weight bonuses, performance bonuses, that are not part of what's called the principal terms of the offer sheet. And Houston is only required to match the principal terms. And so when you matched it, there's no reason to pay a more than you would have had to. And BJ Armstrong and Demo didn't like that aspect of it. And so then they said, hey, we're not going to report. Calvin Watkins reported that the reason that they weren't reporting was due to this difference with the amount of money. And so now it looks like they have struck a deal, because Houston's options were to either just force him to play on that contract, or they could just make him a restricted free agent again, completely invalidate the match when he didn't show up for his physical, and then sign whatever deal with him they wanted to. And it looks like the parties actually struck a deal that certainly the Rockets liked better, because number one, now it's just as if he had signed a normal contract and restricted free agency. He still can't be traded before the trade deadline, but he could be traded after the season. He can be traded in the summer now, which he wouldn't have been able to do if they had just if he were operating on the contract that got matched. And then they also have that guarantee date later into July now, so that they can have flexibility during the summer and just cut him or move him, neither of which they could have done under the old contract if they want to do something else this summer. So Demo, for his part, does get this year's salary fully guaranteed right away, which is better than what the contract with the Nets would have done, although it's hard to imagine a situation in which he would have gotten cut earlier by March, you would say, at least if he were with the Nets. With the Rockets, maybe not, because they prize their flexibility a lot. So that's one aspect of it. And then the other aspect is that he gets in the contract, it sounds like, those same incentives, many of which the weight, the offseason workout stuff would have been very easily achievable. I think both of these were bad deals for the players, especially because it's still 4 years. You still have three non-guaranteed years on the end of it, which for a contract that's significantly above the minimum like this is basically unheard of to have that. I mean, maybe his back is really just that jacked up, but why if you're Demo, and I said this before, put those two non-guaranteed years on the very end. Why not just make it a two-year contract to begin with, which is kind of what was being offered, because there's nothing good that can come out of those last two non-guaranteed years if you're Demo. Either you're outperforming it and now you're locked in for a low salary, or they just cut you because you're not up to it. Like, there's no upside there. Maybe you can make the argument that to even get an offer at all, they had to put those two non-guaranteed years on the end of it. But he basically was being offered, you know, $7 million with a non-guaranteed second year. I would much rather have, if I were him, $7 million a year for 2 years without those two non-guaranteed years on the end of it. Do you agree with that, Danny?
I do. And you can also just take the qualifying offer, and then he would have been unrestricted over the summer. Like, that's better than this too.
He blew it there. Like, the qualifying offer was $4.4 million, but now to not be locked in, and even if the Rockets cut him this summer, it's going to be after everyone has spent their money probably, so that's not going to be good for him either. I think it seems like I absolutely would have just played on the qualifying offer this year, I think, and then if this is all the guaranteed money that you're going to get, it's just so you can get your freedom again. Maybe this back thing is just so bad that like it's a ticking time bomb, and getting $9 million now instead of $4 million means so much more to him. I don't think that that's the case. He played last year down the end of the year. It's not great when you're trading a first round pick for him, as the Pistons were. Then they voided voided the trade. So I guess the question is, were you better off with just the deal with the Rockets that would have been in place initially? That's tough. I mean, he would have still gotten the $8 million guaranteed this year. Yeah, I think he probably was, because he would have gotten his money almost certainly this year, all of it, before that March 1st. And then forcing the Rockets to make a decision, like if they cut him, I guess the thing is, though, if they cut him by that point, it looks so bad. Like, is anyone else really going to sign you then? So
but at least you get a chance. Like now you get later in the process and you can prove it in as a playoff player, whatever you want to do. Now you don't get a chance.
Well, yeah, I guess that's true, but it's because he could have signed with another playoff team, but presumably he would have had to have been pretty bad this year to get cut in March. And just the fact, though, I would have really liked to have had the ability to veto a trade rather than just getting sent somewhere. I think that would have been nice to have. I think I probably would have preferred the match contract, but it's not cut and dried to me at all. It seems like you think it is, though.
That might be a little strong, but I do prefer the original one to this, and I prefer the qualifying offer to both.
All right, well, I'm looking forward to seeing what he does on the court. Is he going to be their backup center? Harrell has been playing well, and Nene has not been playing as much. I think I can't remember whether he's been back at all, but he's had some knee soreness, which that type of thing happens to him pretty regularly. So this is needed insurance. Maybe he'll play a little bit as a backup four as well, though I don't see him that way in D'Antoni's system unless he's a much, much better shooter than he's shown so far this year. Let's get to some other news. We'll try and fly through some of this stuff. Bobby Brown had to be waived for Demo. He was out of the rotation. The Hawks, Kent Bazemore, and this is from a couple days ago, missed a couple games due to right knee soreness. He quietly has been awful this year, and maybe that injury issue has something to do with it. Spencer Dinwiddie, formerly of the Pistons and the Bulls, and then the Windy City Bulls, who's having a nice season so far in the D League. He got signed to a partially guaranteed 3-year deal with the Nets. We don't know exactly how much that's for yet. I'm guessing the guarantee is pretty small. For the Lakers, D'Angelo Russell has returned to practice, as has Nick Young. Good news for Young is I think some people feared that he had a torn Achilles, and instead it was just a calf injury. They are aiming to play on Monday at Sacramento. Bad news for the Sacramento Kings. This is actually DeMarcus Cousins has always said, hey, why does everyone think I'm such a bad guy? I've never gotten in trouble with the law. Now he actually has. He has not, no criminal charges have been filed over a nightclub incident with he and Matt Barnes, but they have already been sued for assault. Some of the allegations are a little bit troubling, basically saying that Matt Barnes grabbed this female plaintiff by the neck and began choking her. And then another of the plaintiffs tried to help the woman, and DeMarcus Cousins punched the person who tried to come to her help. Matt Barnes then elbowed the woman in the face, knocking her unconscious, and that DeMarcus and Barnes then threw the gentleman who tried to come to her help and proceeded to intentionally punch and kick the plaintiff in the head, torso, and lower body. Now, these are just the allegations of the civil complaint. We'll see whether there's enough here to actually lead to criminal charges, but disturbing allegations certainly out of this incident. And then there's also a video afterwards in which the defendants are heard kind of summarizing their role in the fight with not a ton of contrition, I guess we'll put it that way. So any reaction to that at all? I mean, I think that this is just getting Matt Barnes. Sounds like he wasn't the greatest influence on Cousins in this situation. And Barnes, of course, has been known to be rather volatile both on and off the court.
It's certainly an unfortunate situation, and you want to focus on the allegations, and the situation is far, far more important than the basketball part of it. But also, Sacramento has already dealt with a criminal assault issue with Darren Collison this year, and so it compounds that. I mean, now if there's an issue with these two guys, you're at almost a quarter of their team.
The NBA has generally waited for the legal process to resolve itself. I'm not sure exactly where the criminal investigation is right now. The last I'd heard, they just wanted to talk to Barnes and Cousins. There probably is more to the story than this. I'm sure that they will claim that there's some sort of provocation involved. And yeah, it's definitely an issue, though. I want to stress again, I'm not saying that all this happened. These are just the allegations in a complaint, but certainly something to keep an eye on going forward. Some more injury stuff here. James Ennis still out another 7 to 10 days. The Memphis swingman still has that calf injury, and at that point, he's just going to be reevaluated. He's been doing some light shooting. That's about it. The Heat doesn't look like any reinforcements are coming soon for them. Josh Richardson still out three more games. Waiters hoping to play at some point next week as well. Justice Winslow not traveling with the team on this current road trip either. Luke Babbitt has a hip injury. James Johnson is out with a rotator cuff injury. They're going to be looking for an injury exception. They basically have 8 healthy players right now. And then for New Orleans, more injury woes for them. Jrue Holiday has turf toe. He's missed a couple of games now. There's no timetable, but turf toe is not something that I think resolves quickly. This is something that I could see as an issue that's going to linger and be, you know, a week or two type of thing. That's just kind of my eyeballing it and guessing. I could be wrong there. Tyreek Evans, his knee is supposedly about ready to go. This is about the time he was targeting, and now he has a calf injury, so he's got to rehab that. And as we know, one of the Dunked On podcast axioms is that calf injuries linger. For the Celtics, Isaiah Thomas is out a few games with a groin strain. He's not going to play tonight. He had a platelet-rich plasma injection to help it heal. It seems like this is something that has been bothering him for a time. So you have to imagine after that he may miss a few games. They killed the Magic without him the other night, but they play the Raps tonight. It's not going to look good. So we'll see more time for Terry Rozier and Jaylen Braun, see some more, maybe Marcus Smart playing some point guard too, which is something that I'll be very interested to see there. What else we got?
The Jazz, basically their whole team is still hurt. Favors is probably out. It sounds like a minimum of 2 more weeks. Gordon Hayward missed the game against the Warriors due to the finger issue. Rodney Hood still out with his hamstring issue. George Hill sprained toe. Alec Burks still out with the same issue. And have you heard a timeline on him?
Well, I haven't heard one other than just that I think I missed this when it first came down, but Quinn Snyder back at the end of November said they were expecting him to be out a further 1 to 2 months.
Okay.
I would take the long end of that potential timetable. And Favors, you know, he hasn't really progressed at all. It sounds like he's just doing a little bit of shooting with that bone bruise in his knee. So you have to imagine he's not be back at any point in the next couple of weeks either. They've been great even without him, but they got to at least get Hayward, Hill, and Hood all back. Hood aggravated his hamstring against the Suns the other night, and the Jazz basically had to punt. And I don't know, maybe Hayward's thing was so bad that he would have sat out anyway, but with everybody out and playing the Warriors, it basically made sense to just let him get some rest for that finger, which he's re-aggravated a few times and already missed a bunch of time having broken that. Jared Bayless also still out with some wrist soreness. I mean, he came back for a couple of days, but really has been out nearly the entire year. Doesn't seem like his return is imminent either. And I think that is all we have here in terms of the injury news. We will get to the mailbag momentarily, but first, this from Movement Watches. This is just an excellent way to go for your holiday shopping. And what I suggest that you do is just go to that mvmtwatches.com/capspace URL and go check out the watches there. I think you'll be extremely impressed by the quality of watches they have, starting at just $95, and it'll end up being even less than that for you once you use that /capspace URL to get 15% off with free shipping and free returns. I've been really impressed by the quality of mine. I have the gunmetal sandstone. My girlfriend, she has this one whose name escapes me, but gold band, black face. She was really, really happy to get that. My mom actually bought one for herself, bought one for the holidays for her nieces. My cousins, they really like theirs as well. They all four of them actually got together in Chicago because my girlfriend is there right now, and she was telling me how they all were mutually admiring their watches. And at a department store, this type of watch would be $300-$500, but they've cut out the middleman, they've cut out the retail markup, and they're giving you the best possible price now. That's why they've sold over 500,000 watches in 160 countries. So if you're one of our international listeners, this is a great way to support the show. I also would encourage you too, if you get one of the products that are our sponsors, just tweet at me at NateDuncanMBA. Show me the confirmation. Let me know how you like it. And maybe we'll even use some of those testimonials in future advertising. If obviously you think it's good. And if by some chance the sponsor's not working out for you, I would like to know that too, because we want to make sure that we're recommending great products for you. So go to mvmtwatches.com/capspace. Get that 15% off it, your watch or watches for the holiday. Join the movement. All right, what do we got first here, Denny?
So the first question is, what players could draw the most benefit from being on a new team, either by trade or free agency? They used Harrison Barnes to Dallas as an example.
This is an interesting one. I had this whole list of guys. I think the number one for me, I put 5 exclamation points next to it, is Aaron Gordon.
Yep, totally fine with that. Omri Caspi could be helped a lot too. And there are a couple of guys who will never be traded who I think are being poorly served by their surrounding talent. Karl-Anthony Towns, Kristaps Porzingis, maybe Paul George, but those guys aren't going to get traded, so that's sort of a different thing.
Yeah, and I think those guys are still getting plenty of offensive opportunities.
Sure.
And, you know, a team like the Knicks, for example, I mean, I know that they have Melo and Rose are kind of viewed as a little bit high usage, kind of ball hoggy at times. But, I mean, Porzingis is not a guy who's going to create a ton of his own one-on-one offense yet. He's improving a little bit in that area, but I think, you know, 24% usage, which is about what he's at right now. I don't know that that's going to increase. It would be nice if he can play center, but as we talked about on the Twitter NBA show, he does have some limitations for playing center. His defensive rebounding is not that great. He's still, I think, can really get beasted in the post by certain centers. So I think he does need to play some four still. He's obviously struggles there on defense, but I think that's more the nature of the player than how he's being used. George, I think it's more to me about they just haven't really put that much shooting around him, and they're just not really going to maximize themselves as a team. And I do think, you know, Ellis and Teague are really, you know, kind of poor partners for him. I did like them getting Thaddeus Young at the four. I think that's something that can help him. But overall, I think he's probably not going to have as good a year as he had last year. He hasn't been so far. He wasn't really even in the discussion for us in the All-NBA teams. Both offensively and defensively, I think he's not being used as well as he could. And then Towns, you know, we've talked about how we want to see him play more center, play with some more spacing around him.
Another group that you could just put all together is every non-Embiid center on the Sixers, just because moving two of them would certainly help them for opportunity purposes.
Yeah, I think that's, and it's not even so much opportunity for me either as it is just the guys being used wrong even when he is playing. And so I think the biggest category of those is guys who are playing the three who really are much more effective at the four, and Aaron Gordon is the number one of those for me, because he really, I think, would just be so much more effective as a rim runner, getting out in transition. His spot ups, he's improved a little bit there, but just not a good enough shooter or ball handler to play the three. If he's playing more four, then he can get more of those wide open spot up opportunities. He can drive by guys on closeouts, maybe get a chance to do some more passing. Playing next to another combo forward who can shoot, I think, would be so useful for him and his offensive development. He just is not there at all offensively as a three. And not only is he playing the three, but he's playing the three on a team that just has no spacing at all. Although that starting lineup that they're running out there now is a little bit better because they have Ibaka, Fournier, and Augustin, who are all decent shooters next to him. So that helps a little bit. But still, I really would like to see him playing more of the four position on offense. And then Luol Deng and Solomon Hill, both expensive free agent guys. The reason that they were able to glean those contracts is because they were playing at the four. Neither of them are great shooters, but they can be good shooters at the four. At the three, not really as much. They're below average shooters, positional shooting for the three. They can't get to the rim really against threes either. And part of their versatility defensively is that they can guard threes and fours, not really having a chance to do that. So I think both of those guys could be a lot more useful. And then another one that I had was Norman Powell. He's being used fine, but having him being able to just guard ones and twos maybe more than threes would be nice. They don't really have anyone to guard threes when he's in there. He kind of has to take on these guys that he's just too small to guard. And then, you know, he just has a lot of guys in front of him who probably, you know, should be. I mean, I think Terrence Ross, it's fair to say with the way he's shooting, has outplayed him and deserves to be ahead of him in the rotation. But he's someone I think could be maybe even a starting two guard in this lead, maybe, you know, a Courtney Lee type of player at some point in his career, maybe even with a little bit more juice off the bounce.
I'm intrigued by whether there's a clear-cut candidate in Portland's front court, because they have a lot of guys that just, I mean, maybe Ed Davis fits in this, because Davis...
Yeah, Myers Leonard offensively, I think, would be one. Like him playing at center offensively, I don't know if he can hold up there defensively, but he's definitely playing him at the four is not how he's going to succeed.
Yeah.
Robertson, you can throw into that. Guys playing the three who should be playing the four on offense category. Ben McLemore too is a good one, I think.
Oh yeah, I like McLemore a lot for this.
He could benefit from a change of scenery. And I think Dante Exum too, we talked about how I think he should go to the D League, giving him a little bit more of a chance to just make mistakes and explore really what he's capable of as a player, never having played high level basketball with the ball in his hands, to just understand what his capabilities are. He's just, you know, a little bit too worried about making mistakes on this Jazz team that's trying to win, and especially, you know, Shelvin Mack's ahead of him in the rotation, and he should be. But if Exum is going to really develop to his potential, which, you know, is starting to look less likely, Granny's coming off the ACL injury, you'd like to see him in a place where he can kind of, you know, just be the backup point guard and be like the main guy trying to run things.
Is it a victory for the Bulls that Jimmy Butler did not make either of our lists?
Well, again, I mean, I think he himself is being used in the most actualized way. It's kind of more maybe the talent around him. I think that's sort of like a less egregious version of players who would be answers to this question.
Sure.
What non-rookie scale players do you think have the best value contracts in the league right now? Steph is obvious. I'm thinking guys like Marcus Morris, who have a few years left at a really cheap price. So a few things what we'll do as a caveat here. We're not counting max guys in this, especially guys who signed maxes under the old cap 2015 or earlier. And we're not going to count rookie contracts or even guys who are on their first contract either, because there's just too many of those. That's too easy.
Or guys who expire this year, because in terms of surplus value, which is my focus for this question, you're not providing a ton of surplus value.
Yes, thank you. So I had four that I thought are clearly above the rest. Kemba Walker, Isaiah Thomas, Avery Bradley, Jay Crowder.
Three of them on the same team. It's amazing.
Yeah, which is absolutely remarkable. I mean, I think that aspect, even more so than the whole Brooklyn fleecing, is what has enabled the Celtics to really be pseudo contenders here while still having just enviable flexibility.
Yeah, and a couple guys that I would add, I think Crowder is number one with Kemba being in the mix there because they both have years left. Al-Farouq Aminu, after this year, still has 2 years, $14 million. So basically, it's Jay Crowder's contract, but a year shorter. Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, both technically not max guys, making good money. And Eric Bledsoe, who is not really at the same caliber because he's still making a lot of money, but he's an incredibly good basketball player.
Yeah, I mean, Green and Thompson I kind of took out of there just because they're pretty close to the max.
Oh, and Chris Middleton.
Yeah, Chris Middleton is on there. Derek Favors, making only $11 million a year. I know he's been injured, but when healthy, he's been a top 30 player in the league probably at that point. I think, what about just contracts that were signed in the summer of 2016 where value contracts were much harder to find any pop out to you there. I mean, they're never going to be as good just because the cap went up by so much, but I think it's still worth recognizing the teams that were able to do well, even under those circumstances.
Malcolm Delaney is the best one for me. Oh, but he's first contract, so I guess that doesn't count.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a little different. He's a veteran free agent. Yeah, he and Kuz, those Euro guys, I think are solid. The number one for me, I think, would be Mo Harkless, who has been excellent so far this year, and it was only 22 when he signed that. And Evan Fournier, another one who, well short of the max, I thought was a good contract. And in the other category, too, with the way he's playing, we got to say this one, Lou Williams.
Yep.
$7 million a year for a guy who's, you know, in the top 25 in the league in PR and basically has been keeping this Lakers franchise afloat. It has been a pretty remarkable value. And everyone missed that. We liked that contract at the time, this for the sixth man of the year. And then, you know, we got lost in the Laker morass last year. But Lou Williams is really good. And we shouldn't have forgotten that.
We should not have. I'll do the next one. Of all the franchises yet to win an NBA championship, which ones have the best and worst chances to get their first trophy in the next 5 to 10 seasons?
So let's look at the list here of teams that have yet to win a championship. Clippers, Grizzlies, Hornets, Nuggets, Pelicans, Raptors, Timberwolves, Indiana Pacers, because the question specified NBA championship, Brooklyn Nets, same thing, Utah Jazz, same thing, Sacramento Kings, Orlando Magic, and I realize that the Rochester Royals like won in like 1951 or whatever it was. The Kings ridiculously have like the gold patch on the back of their uniforms for having won one. That's once you've reached like 8 iterations of your franchise ago, I'm probably not gonna count it. Magic, I think I might have said already. Pelicans, Thunder, again, same thing. We're not counting that Sonics championship for them. Suns.
And the Timberwolves.
I said Wolves.
Oh, okay.
I accidentally wrote them again.
they're so central to this that they have to be in it. They're so nice they get named twice.
All right, so not a ton of optimism out of those teams, but my pick for the best three out of those, Wolves, I think would probably be number one with the talent that they have that we think can be good. And just as a guiding principle here, I felt that uncertainty and bad is almost better. Like the Suns, I would say, actually have like a better chance than the Hornets right now, because I just, even though the Hornets are way better than the Suns right now, I just don't foresee any kind of a path. Whereas the Suns, because it's more uncertain, even though they are really bad right now, you can envision that maybe it could be possible. Like that was kind of one of the guiding principles I had. Yeah, so Wolves, Clippers, and Jazz were my top three here. And then the Raptors, I would have been fourth, but again, I don't see how they are going to overcome Cleveland, much less any of the juggernauts that are going to come out of the West anytime soon.
I have the same top three. I struggled a lot with the order because the Clippers are the best team right now. Like they are, as even after the game on Wednesday, they are a legitimate championship contender. But I would go Minnesota, Utah, LA, just because I don't think it's hard for the Clippers to get there this year. And every year after this is going to be harder than now. And there's so much uncertainty. And the other part for the Clippers is once they lose one of their guys, whether that's Blake or CP this year or DeAndre next summer, it will be very hard for them to get back there because of all the money they're spending on the other guys. So they're in that camp.
Yeah. And but always a good free agent market as well. I think.
Yeah, but they have to have money. Like that's the problem.
Sure. Yeah, but if they have to rebuild, you know, if things just go badly and then Doc Rivers leaves and they just have to straight up rebuild. I mean, this is a 10-year period we're talking about. Maybe they could get back to being good again. You know,
I think that's true. And Ballmer, I think I have some faith that he can hire a good next guy to run their team.
I'm a little less sanguine on that one, but I think the Clippers, yeah, to me, they would be probably like right up there with the Spurs and the Cavs if something were to happen to the Warriors, if they get upset or get some injury issues, or probably really two injury issues if we're being honest here. I think that's why you have to put the Clips in there, whereas the Raps, even if like LeBron James gets hurt, I just, you know, don't see them beating any of the teams coming out of the West this year. Maybe I'm underrating them, the Jazz, because the Jazz have kind of the same problem. If they could keep their team together, though, I think if the Warriors start to wane, the Spurs, you have to look like they're probably going to get a little bit worse. So will the Clippers. There's no real other rising power unless you're going to say that the Wolves are going to pass them. So that's kind of my thinking with the Jazz. And I think that they just have a little bit more upside than this Raptors team because I think their defense can be awesome. And their offense, they have enough firepower that they can be pretty good too. Like I think that Jazz can kind of be like what the Raps have been these last couple of years, but with like better defense.
In terms of the worst, my number one one surprised me, but when I really thought about it and used the exercise, I'm relatively comfortable with it, is the Grizzlies. Because the Grizzlies are older, they can be good, they're a wonderful success story right now, but they owe draft picks. It's going to be a lot harder for them to get that good to be a championship team in the next 10 years with the obligations they have. They're also not a free agent destination. You'll see that with all three of the teams that I picked. Number two is the Sacramento Kings. They have a lot of outstanding obligations, including the one to the Sixers. The difference there, why I put the Grizzlies behind, I guess you could say, behind the Kings, is because there's an outside chance that what they get for DeMarcus Cousins could become a star. Like, they have that chance. And then third, I would have the Orlando Magic. Possibility of free agents. They've been toyed with a lot of times, but they don't have star talent now. And I feel like they could move on this list based on what they do this year. Because if they do a panic trade and try to buy now this year, then that could be even worse.
Yeah, there actually were a lot of candidates here for the worst, because you kind of have, all right, the Nets, the Kings, what they have in common is that they're bad and they don't have draft, they're lower on draft assets. And they might even, you know, the Kings might even have to get worse still before they get better once Cousins departs, as we think seemingly is inevitable at this point. So there's that category, but they are at least still going to be bad. The Grizz, even maybe, like, in some ways the Pacers and Hornets, you could make the argument that they're even in the worst case because they don't have a path to a championship. They're good enough that they're going to be, you know, kind of in the lower end of the Eastern playoff bracket, maybe the middle end if they're lucky, for the next like 3 years or so, 4 years, and then they're going to have to finally get bad again as like Kemba and Paul George and those guys age out. And then they would have to build back up again. And by the time that's over, like, we're probably done with this 10-year window. So in some ways, maybe you could make the argument that the teams that are kind of good, and the Grizz, I think that they are closer to that, the end of their success cycle, where they could get bad and then maybe be getting good again by the end of the 10 years. Whereas for the Pacers and Hornets, maybe it's not quite there. But let me ask you this. I mean, I think I had my worst three as the Kings, Nets, and Magic. But because the Magic just don't have any top end talent on the roster right now, and they seem also that they're not really in like bottoming out type of mindset at the moment. How many of these teams would you be comfortable writing off and saying, no, they're not going to win a championship in the next 10 years?
A disturbingly large amount of them. I mean,
right.
It's pretty incredible when you go through it. I mean, even let's say the Pelicans. Like, the Pelicans have Anthony Davis and he's incredible, but it's going to be really hard for them to get those players. And, you know, they had space last year, couldn't get anybody to come. Their cap situation is going to get more complicated over the years. And
yeah, I mean, the only hope for the Pelicans is that it's actually, again, good for them in terms of their ultimate chance of winning an NBA championship. It's good for them that they're going to be bad again this year, it looks like, because
but they have to be really bad. Like, I mean, granted, this draft, the people who are smarter, who know this stuff, think it's stronger, deeper. But still, I mean, look at last year. They got a pretty good pick and then they ended up with Buddy Hield.
All right. Yeah. I mean, then they would have to not blow the pick, obviously, as well. But at least they could get, like, they should be drafting high enough that maybe you just go for that ridiculous upside guy, which of course they aren't going to do because they're the Pelicans and they don't do that kind of thing. And they haven't for the last 6 years. So I don't know why. I mean, the Pelicans are probably one of the teams that I have the least confidence in their
well,
management.
And there's the ownership issue too. Like, I mean, I think that's yeah. another factor in this. And what one of the yeah. elements
maybe they just get sold. You know, that's but I think
one of the elements that concerns me a lot with this also is that other than the Clippers and the Nets, depending on how you see New York, a lot of these teams are going to struggle to get free agents, and that's one of the easiest ways to become a championship team. I mean, Boston did it without getting free agents because they got two guys via trade, but it's a lot harder. The path is narrower that way than like what Miami did.
I almost wanted to throw the Thunder into that category too, but I think just maybe Oladipo and Steven Adams just blow up so much and they can do a little bit better job, get a little bit more shooting. I mean, if you had Westbrook and Oladipo and Adams and those guys go crazy, and then you put some shooting around those guys, like, there's a way you can still get there. But Westbrook, you know, this is, I know what he's doing this year. His efficiency actually has been going down a little bit recently, but he's got maybe another year at this level, especially when you consider the way in which he plays and the amount of energy and athleticism that takes. I think we're both in agreement that he may not age that well.
Well, and the big question with them is, will they roll the dice and see if he can, if he'll re-sign? Because if they get nothing for him if he leaves, then that basically just guts their franchise again.
All right, so probably easier to say, which of these teams are you not going to write off as like a potential championship contender in the next 10 years. I would say the Nuggets, I would not write off.
Sure. Top end talent.
You know, the Raptors, I would not write off. The Wolves, I would not write off. The Suns, I would not write off just because I think they have like a lot of youth on the roster. They have those Miami picks coming too, which will be useful. The Jazz, I wouldn't write off.
The Clippers and the Wolves, my top three. And then the other ones you mentioned, I think we're in agreement, which is a little bit frustrating to me, but we're in agreement on which teams to not write off. I would love to put the Pacers there, but they're just not close enough.
All right. Yeah. We've really been slogging through here. These are some interesting questions. Actually, great questions this week. This is a little bit quicker. Cy, the photo guy, how much stock can we put in home road splits? What do you take away from the Spurs? Unbeaten at home last year, playing miserably at home and saying unbeaten on the road this year. I take away very, very little, except for Utah and Denver. I actually discount their home performance a little bit just due to the altitude, and also I think a lot of teams come in there, especially going west to east, losing an hour, that's a difficult back-to-back. I mean, road games are harder in the playoffs. Like I don't put much stock in it. I look at the overall performance much more. I don't think that anyone has really ever found a correlation between doing better at home or doing better on the road as far
except
as
for the altitude teams.
I think it means less to do well at home when you're Utah and Denver, because in the playoffs, right, teams have more rest, they acclimate, blah blah.
Right. So yeah, it all ties in with that. And also right now we're dealing with such a small sample size. Like, I mean, you're very beholden to the games that you've played and who you faced and back to backs and all that sort of stuff, because there are a lot of schedule losses over the course of the year, and at this point they comprise a larger part of the sample.
I will get back to the mailbag momentarily, but first this from Indochino, a longtime sponsor of the Dunk Down Basketball Podcast. Actually had a couple of comments on the Twitter NBA show in the Periscope asking if we were wearing Indochino stuff. We were not last week, but I think we're going to this week if you want to check out what some of the suits look like. The story with Indochino: a premium Indochino suit for just $389 using the familiar cap space code. Easy to remember because we talk about cap space all the time on the program. These are made to measure suits that are less expensive than what you're going to get in a department store, which is pretty remarkable. They fit me so much better. I'm kind of an odd shaped guy. I got big shoulders, but not really that big of a chest. So even after they get tailored by the department store, those off the rack suits just don't quite look right. I mean, they're just a little bit too big around the midsection that I've never been able to find a tailor who can fit it perfectly when it's an off the rack suit. Indochino has hundreds of fabrics and patterns as well. You can customize the lapels, give yourself a monogram, the pleats, the jacket lining, and you can go into one of their stores if you are lucky enough to be in one of the cities where they have stores. Someone actually tweeted at me that they went into the store in Soho in New York and got fitted, had a good experience. Or there's a tutorial on their website to submit your body measurements, and in just 4 weeks you can get the best, most stylish suit that you've ever worn once you submit the measurements to them. And again, the way to get started with them, Indochino.com. Enter that code CAPSPACE at checkout, gets you 50% off the regular price, just $389, and shipping is free at Indochino.com. Barkevius Mimo: is the top end talent in the league better now than it was 10 years ago? What would a ranking of the top five players in the league now and top five in the 2006-07 time frame look like to you? All right, yeah.
I'll start this with I'll read out the top five in the MVP 10 years ago. So this was the year Dirk won the MVP. So number five was a 22-year-old LeBron. Number four was 30-year-old Tim Duncan. Number three was 28-year-old Kobe. Two was 32-year-old Steve Nash. I forgot he finished second that year. Number one, 28-year-old Dirk.
Yeah, and a few other guys too needed talking about then. And I even was thinking more, because I think I've made the comment, and maybe this inspired the question, that I think that the tie-in talent now is a little bit better, that was kind of a down period for the MVP. I think I was more, really, it wasn't until LeBron came into his prime in 08-09 type of time period. I mean, LeBron did have, you remember, that crazy 29 of their 30 points in 2007, but then wasn't really able to do anything that was against Detroit in game five on the road to get them to the finals. Then he wasn't able to do anything really against San Antonio in the finals at all. Tracy McGrady was a little, like, he looked like he was going to be like an all-time great superstar, and then once he got into Houston, he really wasn't as good of a player. KG, this was the year before he got traded to Boston. He had a great run in the mid-2000s, but he was on the downside at that point. Minnesota was pretty bad, so I think by then he wasn't really quite the guy that he had been when he was, you know, having some all-time great seasons in the very mid-2000s.
Well, and also, you talked about LeBron, but this is when his other draft class mates, Bosch, Wade, those guys were still a little young. They hadn't gotten all the way there
yet. Well, Wade,
yet. He'd
the
had
other
that
problem
final.
With, well, the other problem, yeah, like, because he was playing, again, at an all-time great level in that finals, and then he had a shoulder injury, missed most of the year. They got swept in the first round by the Bulls that year, and then 07-08, he really missed most of the year again. The Heat won, I think, 15 games that year and got the number two pick. They drafted Beasley, and then Wade came back, played in the Olympics, and then had two more great seasons in Miami as they were kind of just waiting for the summer of 2010, and what he was doing during those periods are certainly, you know, right around where guys like Westbrook and Harden are this year. Our current top five, I think for me, I think it's really even more like a top seven guys with AD, Chris Paul, Steph, LeBron, James Harden, Westbrook, KD and Kawhi. Those are really the very clearly the top seven guys right now. To me, I think that while Dirk had an incredible season that year in 07, he did have a very bad playoffs. They got beat by the We Believe Warriors 4-2. Then Nash, I think, was, while he was just an awesome offensive player, not someone who played both ends very well. Same thing with Dirk. Tim Duncan, a little bit past his prime at age 30, still obviously an awesome player, but not someone I think people were talking about as like the best player in the game anymore. LeBron was a little too young. Kobe, I think, was his best year was 06. That's really, I think, and we'll talk about this more in an upcoming question, I am of the belief that Kobe's peak is very overrated. His longevity is not, but his peak was. There's really only one year where you could say, make a good argument that he was the best player in the league, and that was 06. So and I think he was getting a little bit past his prime here as well. He did win the MVP in 07, but I don't think he should have. And then also Chris Paul was another player who went by 08 was started, you know, having one of his best years, but he actually missed a lot of 07 as well with an injury. So yeah, I do think it is a little bit better now. I mean, you have LeBron played at an all-time level in the finals last year. Steph Curry had one of the best regular seasons of all time last year. I think Kawhi is kind of more along the lines of some of the stars from back then, but I think with the way, and then I think KD also really is right where he is playing right now, is playing at a better level really than anyone reached in that 06-07 season. And then you look at like what Westbrook and Harden are doing so far this year, at least, not so much last year, that they I think they're at kind of a higher level than anyone was that year too. I would only really put Dirk in the category with some of those guys right now, but a difficult question to compare even across eras from 10 years ago, but that's kind of how I see it at this point.
Yeah, and I like how many of the players overlap. I thought that was interesting just because 10 years is long enough, especially for a guy like LeBron, who's just been insane in that way, just his longevity. And also I was amused because I had totally forgotten that Boozer finished ninth in MVP voting that year on the Jazz.
Yeah, well, that was the year he was 25 that year. That was the year that they actually made it to the Western Conference Finals.
Yeah,
he and D-Will were both fantastic. I mean, D-Will was better than him, so a little surprising that he was ahead of him, but nonetheless, I mean, I think that was one of those. And also it was a different time in terms of the awards winning. We can carp about how bad it is now, but it was much better. It's much better now than it used to be when nobody even knew, like, you know, if you had anybody even knew what PR was, that was like impressive.
Next question is from the Luther. Quarter of the season in, seems like the West playoff picture won't
I did have one other point to
sure,
make too.
Go ahead.
Just look at like who like some of the good teams were in 07. Like the Pistons, I think in the East had like the one seed with 53 wins, and like the Bulls won 49 games in the East with nobody. LeBron was good, but he didn't have anybody really on his team. Dirk's team lost in the first round. Like, it was just a crappy playoffs and finals. Like, it was the best series of the playoffs was in the second round between the Suns and the Spurs. I mean, there are really only three good teams that year, all of them in the West. Throw the Mavs in there as well. They won 67 games, but were very lucky with their point differential. The Spurs won 58, actually had a bigger point differential than the Mavs did that year. And so you just look at like how good the teams were. I don't think they're even necessarily as good as they are now. And especially as they were maybe last year, now that KD has joined up in Golden State, that's reduced Oklahoma City a little bit. But I think the top end talent is better. All right, so sorry to interrupt you here. Let's continue.
Okay, quarter of the season in, seems like the West playoff picture isn't likely to change. Which of the non-playoff teams so far, so like outside the top eight, do you see as having the potential to actually overtake one of the current playoff teams?
Yeah, we can actually, we'll do the other one too, about like how many of the playoff spots are going to turn over between the end of the season and the beginning as well. Actually, so yeah, let's fold that one in too.
Sure, I can read that question too. It was basically over under 15 teams that are currently in a playoff spot will make it into the playoffs in April.
All right. So in the West, I think the teams that still potentially could make it. I agree. If you had to put a gun to my head, I would say it's more likely than not. I wouldn't say that necessarily. I think Sacramento, the Lakers, and Denver are the ones that I give a chance to. And the Wolves are 6-16 right now. But I don't see this Blazers team, the way they're defending right now, running away and hiding. And they actually have been lucky to be 500 so far. I know they've been missing Aminu, and I know that they generally will play a little bit better towards the end of the season. You have a history of doing that lately, but nonetheless, I see them kind of staying around 500, maybe a couple games over by the end of the year. And then there's always injuries that could hit. Memphis could still fall off a cliff. They've been doing it with smoke and mirrors. They had another ridiculous 2-point win down the stretch last night. Marc Gasol has been doing it in the clutch. It's been completely insane for them. You noted that the Pelicans are 5-4 when Drew plays. That's great, but they're also 7-16, and Drew might be hurt again. AD is always going to miss. He's going to miss 10-15% of their schedule. They have no chance in any of those games. So I think the Pels are done. I think the Wolves, you got to say, are probably done.
They're close, but remember that the right now the current 9 seed is the Lakers at 10-14. So yeah, it sounds bad that the New Orleans is 7-16, but it's not that far away.
Which of those teams do you give the best chance between Sacramento, the Lakers, and Denver?
The Kings and the Nuggets, because they can play better than they have so far, and I don't necessarily know that Denver would do this. I wouldn't, but they could theoretically do by now, which is the same logic with Minnesota. You know, if they wanted to give up a first round asset or something like that to get better, they could, but I don't expect it.
Yeah, I don't either, especially since the Wolves owe that lottery protected first rounder to the Hawks from the Adrian Payne trade, which didn't work out too well. I mean, I think actually the Lakers have been the most injured. Denver's been pretty injured too, but they've had basically everyone back for a time now other than Gary Harris, and they're still been pretty ugly. I think the Lakers have been the most injured. I mean, when they've been healthy, they've been right around 500 so far, although their point differential looks awful these days because they've just been getting blown out on this with so many guys injured. Maybe they'll start looking better. I still don't think that any of those teams is likely to make it, but when you throw in the chance of an injury and all those, I mean, the Wolves even have a decent chance of making it. So what's your answer on the other one, over under 15 teams that are in the playoffs? We should look at just what the standings are at the moment for those who are not as up on that. In the East, your bottom five teams are the 11-9 Bucks, Knicks and Bulls, both 12-10, Pistons 12-12. I expect them to move up more than move down. And then you've got the Pacers 11-11, Hawks 11-12, Magic at 10-13. Those would be the three that I think could get in there in the East. I think I'm probably ready to write off the Wizards now.
I'm not all the way there yet, but for me, the answer is still under, because there are a couple different things that can fundamentally change this. Injuries being the biggest one in the West, just because we think it's likely that all these teams make it in. It's also likely that one of them will suffer an injury. We saw this with Memphis last year. Of course, Memphis still made it in. And then in the East, I like a couple of the non-playoff teams to jump in. You know, Atlanta, they dealt with that injury to Millsap and just kind of a general malaise. And Indiana and Orlando have enough talent to jump in. And also, those are so close that any sort of stumble, like what happened to the Bulls and Jimmy Butler last year, you know, like even if it's a temporary stumble, that's not enough to keep a team in.
If Jimmy Butler gets hurt, the Bulls are like a 25-win team. So, I mean, maybe if they're totally healthy, that they could be better than that. But yeah, Bucks, Knicks, Bulls, I think all of those teams have like a pretty good potential. I like to maybe fall out of it. I'm not saying all of them will, but it wouldn't surprise me to see tailspins from those three teams. Pistons, Hornets, Celtics, Raptors, Cavs, I think you can mark all those down unless there's some sort of a major injury issue. But yeah, I think Pacers, Hawks, and Magic. And I guess I shouldn't quite write off the Wizards yet, but they have to defend better, and that's showing no signs of that happening. But it is possible, you know, because they actually are playing well enough offensively, and defense I think is something that you can improve a little bit better, as we've seen so during the year with the Magic. And then in the West, we talked about already, I mean, I would say Lakers, Kings, and Nuggets, you know, all of them have maybe like a 15-20% chance individually of getting in there, but you add that up and it's kind of around 50%. So I would say if I were like doing the odds, I would put it at like 13.5 of the teams right now to get in, and I think that at least two in the East are going to change.
Yeah, that seems fair.
I had to guess.
Next question is from Bat with 3 T's for whatever reason. If you were personally a free agent, where would you want to go and why?
All right, so I'm 6'6". I'm kind of like a 2'3" in theory. We'll assume that I'm a quality NBA starter, not a stretch at all. My big factors are going to be playing time and money, because guess what? I haven't really made that much money in my career yet compared to an NBA player. And if the money is close, then it would be playing time, then organizational quality and winning, and then the city. So who the teams that theoretically have a hole on the wing for me at this point? New Orleans, Oklahoma City, although I don't think Russell Westbrook would be very fun to play next to because it would just be watch him do something and then shoot you. I would never get to touch the ball. The Bucks could use a two guard, a sweet shooting two guard like me. rugged, tough, scrappy. Miami just needs bodies, so, and that would be pretty nice to play in South Beach. And they're also a team that has developed players pretty well. The Grizz can use some bodies as well. The Clippers, you know, they desperately need a wing to start with. That would be pretty fun to play for them and be like the starter. And then the Nets, obviously, they have nobody either. So those are really the only teams that would have a spot for me right now. Out of those, I'd say probably Clippers first, then Miami, and then I think the Bucks actually would be a pretty fun young team to play with. I can learn some moves from Jabari Parker.
I mean, for me, I think of it in money and then situation. So it would depend on money. Money is obviously important, but
yeah, I mean, we'll assume that all these teams have the money to just pay like a normal starter salary, I think.
Right. Yeah. See, I didn't think of it as much as being a starter, though that is an interesting question. I was thinking of it more as being a bench player. Maybe that's because I was worse at basketball than you. And there, as a 5'10 guy, I'm a straight one. Like, that's just what I am. I thought it'd be really fun to be a backup, like, utility one for the Cavs with LeBron and Kyrie and everything else like that. Same for the Warriors. Those teams are good. But in being a part of a young team that's on their way up, like the Wolves or the Sixers would be a lot of fun as well.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to ask me what team would be the most fun to play for, obviously Golden State, the number one. That's, I mean, not only would you be winning and those guys have a ton of fun playing, but they actually move the ball. So you get to touch the ball like on like the Cavaliers or the Thunder or something. Like you're kind of just waiting in the corner and hope that.
I'm surprised you didn't mention the Spurs. I mean, the Spurs, especially while Pop is their coach, would certainly be high on my list.
Yeah, and they, I could, I think the Spurs are the best organization to work for if you want to like have a post-basketball career in the league, which would be kind of cool too. All right, Lamar Matic. Could any of the contending teams benefit from a trade for Hollis Thompson? So this is Hollis's fourth year, so he's a free agent at the end of this year. He'll be unrestricted. They had a team option on him, which they exercised. They could have made him a restricted free agent this summer at the end of his third year. They elected not to do that. I honestly don't know. Like, he's not, Nick Stauskas is their guy right now at the two. Like, maybe Hollis could be like a poor man's Tony Snell. You know, he doesn't really have the length or athleticism or even like a Snell type. I don't think he has like that versatile of a jump shot from three. He does nothing inside the arc. His career high is 6.6 threes per 36 minutes, which is not incredibly high. And you know, someone like Snell gets his jumper off a little bit more easily. I don't think he really moves the needle. I don't know that he would necessarily be in the rotation for a contender. Maybe he could be. I mean, you know, hey, he shoots well on threes. You know, he kind of looks like he moves his feet okay. Maybe he could be good. But, you know, 61st among small forwards in RPM last year, just has not been playing in any kind of a real playoff situation. I don't think he, and especially because you don't get another year of him either after this, I don't think I would give up necessarily a second rounder for him. Maybe if it's a super low second rounder from a contender, but
to me for certain teams is because, yes, you're right, he's a free agent, but he also has a really low cap hold. So if you're a team like Cleveland
and Bird Right,
you're Cleveland, sure, if you get him and you like him and you can come to an agreement, you can bring him in. The problem is the two teams that are the clearest representations of that set of constraints are the Clippers and the Cavs. Neither one of them has a second round pick until 2019. You clearly don't give up a first for Hollis Thompson at this point. So sure, I think certain teams could benefit from it. He's better than some of the guys they have on their roster, but Philadelphia has to have a reason to do that trade too, and they don't really have bad contracts to send or anything like that. So Hollis might be in the problem area where he's not good enough to give up assets for, but you'd still like to have him.
Yeah, and I just like all these Sixers guys, especially the ones who haven't been the main focus of the offense. I really have a tough time evaluating them. Like Isaiah Cannon was another one who I think has been a little bit of a disappointment shooting the ball so far with the Bulls, although he has been in the rotation. I don't think he's that valuable. I think that would be, I might be willing to take a chance on him, but it's and then maybe re-sign him. It might be nice. Also, the fact that he doesn't have the size to really guard threes, to guard the opposing team's best wing threat, is another reason why I think his value is a little bit lower. But he is someone that I've wondered about, and I would say that category of players into which he falls into are the guys that I have the least sense of, like, whether he's actually any good or not. But I think it's worth investigating. Like, I understand the point of the question.
So do I. Emerald Flair, under Emerald underscore Flair. The CBA is filled with rules named after special situations or predicaments of certain players, bird rights, arenas, provision. I will also note that the actual CBA does not use any of those. Those are colloquial names for it. In the upcoming CBA, what provision would you like to see implemented using a current player's situation as the model for the rule?
I came up with two. One of them, it sounds like, is already going to be in there. The Deion Waiters rule, where he had his qualifying offer pulled after the market had already dried up this year, which I thought was really unfair to him that you're allowed to do that. Under this CBA, you can do that through July 23rd. Now it sounds like you're not going to be able to do that anymore. And then the other one would be what I would call the KJ McDaniels rule. JP Tokido is in this category too, where I think the required tender for second rounders, now all you have to do is, in the first 2 weeks of September, give a 1 year non-guaranteed minimum contract for the minimum, which is, you know, like $500,000. And that's all you have to do to retain someone's rights as a second rounder. Whereas I would at least say, A, move that deadline up. So to at least like the end of July. So if you're not going to give the guy the required tender, you can at least, you know, he knows that he can go to Europe. And B, I think that should be a little bit higher in this day and age, where, because now if you're in the second half of the second round, it's almost like a punishment to be selected. You would rather just be a free agent and pick your team. So they should at least have to pay you enough, you know, at least offer, like, you know, 1 year guaranteed money or something. You should have to at least do that to keep the guy on the team, protect those second rounders a little bit more. If you're going to take away their freedom, they should at least be able to get that, you know, not like force them to go be stashed in Europe and then they're never on the team, but yet they don't have their freedom to go play for whatever NBA team. You know, 6 years from now, you shouldn't be able to just hold on to a second round draft pick for that long unless, like, you both team and player are in agreement.
Yeah, that actually ties in with one of mine. So I had two. I like yours as well. I should note that. The Austin Rivers clarification, which is just making completely sure we know what teams can't go over the declined option year salary for when a player gets his option year declined and then gets traded. It is relatively known, like, what would happen, but I'd like for it to be codified. And then the other one, I'm calling
to be clear on what you're talking about there, because I think some people might have been lost. Austin Rivers, the Pelicans declined his fourth year rookie option. If he stays on the team, then they could not re-sign him as a free agent for any more in the first year than he would have made under his rookie contract. But he then got traded to Boston and then got traded to LA. And the CBA says basically, like, the team, something along the lines of, like, the team that that declined the option can't sign him to more. It seems pretty clear that once he gets traded, whoever acquires him can't do that either. But yeah, it would be nice to just have that laid out in the CBA. That's what you're saying, right?
That is exactly what I was saying. And, like, even in a hypothetical, like, what if it was Boston? What if Boston had wanted to pay him more money? Like, it's too murky. It's murkier than it should be. And then the other one ties in with what you were saying before. I'd call it the Luis Scola rule, which would be that there is an expiration date on rights held for second round picks. I mean, I don't know what it would be. I think it's, for me, ideally would be 2 or 3 years, but it's completely unfair. I would even have an expiration on first round picks, probably of like 4 or 5 years, and just say at that point, you need to just let him go.
Will DeBeastly, if you were Tom Thibodeau and had to deal one of LaVine or Wiggins, who would you choose? Let's not spend too much time on this one. I think it would be LaVine, though, but it's not that clear of a case to me, because just Wiggins development in the floor game has been so troubling so far. I would at least listen to what's out there for Wiggins, though, and see, because Wiggins could get more for you potentially, but I think there's no way you're going to get back that level of upside at this point for Wiggins. I would listen. I think teams would probably value him more than LaVine. I think it's possible LaVine is better, but ultimately it's probably going to be.
I would, same basic line, I would rather trade LaVine. But I think that it's more likely another team would make a mistake on an offer for Wiggins. So you listen.
I will say this. If Wiggins doesn't develop, and his 3-point shooting has been better this year, but he's not, I don't think he's ever going to be like some pure spot up guy. If he doesn't develop defensively, it becomes very hard to fit a team around him, because whereas LaVine, he's a 2, you can get in another 3-and-D guy next to him. But with Wiggins, he's your 3. If he's not going to provide any defense and not provide enough shooting, leaving, now you really need to have another guy who can guard some of the best players and also shoot the ball. And that player is very rare. LaVine, it's kind of more, it's easier to just fill out a good team around him if Wiggins doesn't develop. If he does develop defensively, then, you know, those concerns are moved.
Are you ready for the next one?
Yeah, this one's going to take a while. So let's hit it.
From Down East Sun, enjoyed listening to the re-aired all-time NBA rank breakdown. My question is, how would you personally rank Dirk, Kobe, and KG? For reference, Kobe was 12th, Dirk was 17th, and Garnett was 21st.
I think you really could pick any of them. I didn't have the time to compare them to the other players who are around that range in the ESPN rankings, but I think comparing them to each other is absolutely fascinating. I think you really, this is just an eye of the beholder question almost, to say who is the greater player among those three guys. I think Kobe was a little bit high for me. I would probably have them all clustered right around in the mid to late teens. I think that KG had the highest peak of any of those guys because of his defense. I think that his 2004 was the best season that any of those guys had. But also, it really was only 04, 05 were probably the only seasons that you would have KG in the conversation for the best player in the league. His 05 season is a very underrated one. He led the league in a lot of the advanced metrics, but just the Wolves were right around 500 because everybody else who was on that team just completely fell off a cliff. I don't know how much KG, at least at the time, playing power forward next to a traditional center. In these days now, he probably would play a lot of center the way that a guy like Anthony Davis does or Draymond Green does, and he would be awesome in that role. He could do more switching. I think he would be better in today's game. They also would be having him shoot threes in today's game, which he had the capability to do. There was a brief time where he was shooting threes, and then he basically just stopped doing it. So I think that those 2 years to me were probably better than any of those guys had. Kobe had the longest longevity, but there really is and his 06 season, he was really, that's probably the only season, as I said, that I think he's in the conversation for the best player in the league. Probably would have been my MVP that year. His 08 year was more, it should have been Chris Paul. That was more of a kind of a career achievement season award because he hadn't won one yet. But I think there's, for Bryant, his career high in PER was only 28, and he only had three seasons over 25. If you look at like the advanced stats page, he doesn't have any black ink, which is basically, you know, when you led the league, other than usage rate. But in his defense, his team's always had really good offenses. Even when he was on the team by himself with nobody around him other than Lamar Odom, those were still top 10 offenses basically just because of him. And even despite the fact that he was known as being selfish, I don't really care for him as a teammate at all. I think that the allegations that he had in Colorado in the summer of 2003, that was something that really kind of ruined his training that year. That was a self-inflicted situation, ruined what could have been that really good team. And I also like his playoff performance is a little bit overrated as well. He played so many games that he has some really iconic moments, like in that first round in 2006 against the Suns, where he had 50 and had some ridiculous shots in that game four, the 48 point game in game four of the 2000 finals. Doesn't really have much of an iconic moment from those last two Laker championships, other than maybe you would say game six of the Phoenix series, where he basically hit a bunch of incredible ISO jumpers to win that game on the road. And he had a lot of times where he came up short in the playoffs too, that people just forget about. I mean, the 6 of 24 in the game that they won in game 7 in 2010, where he basically just quit playing in, I think, game 7 of that same 2006 series against the Suns after they blew the 3-1 lead. The 04 finals, he was awful, got completely shut down by Tayshaun Prince. I think that he definitely has had a worse overall playoff resume than Dirk, although Dirk wasn't great either because they lost in the first round in 2007. But I think Dirk's 2011 and Dirk's 2006 playoffs, at least until the finals, were far better than anything that Kobe did as far as a full playoffs. And then Dirk, you know, he always basically made an efficient offense by himself for his entire career. Even now in the twilight of his career, he does that. He's probably the best offensive player of the three, but by the worst on D by far. I probably would go with Dirk eventually, just because of, I thought he was a little bit better in the playoffs. And but this is a really hard call. You could go in any of these directions to me. I mean, what is your kind of thinking off the top of your head after that incredibly long monologue? That I only did that because you're feeling sick, though. I would never go on that long without that.
I would have KG first. His defense was at a different level, and he's a big man, so big man defense actually matters. He was huge on the championship team. And Kobe, his defense is really overrated. It's a similar thing to what has happened with LeBron in recent years, which is that he could bring it at certain moments. So people go, oh, he's good defensively, but 75 to 80% of the time, he wasn't that guy. And so I don't give much credit if you are capable and not doing it. And Kobe was a spectacular talent. I mean, I think he's one of the most talented guys in the league, but it didn't always manifest itself. And I also, it's interesting that you bring up PER, because as an intensely high volume guy, Kobe is a player who is overrated by PER, in my opinion. And the playoff issue is huge, because yeah, he did have more moments, but the reason he had more moments is because he has vastly superior surrounding talent. If you put either of the other two guys with prime Shaquille O'Neal, they're going to have a lot of great playoff moments too. KG never played with a teammate as good as those guys, neither did Dirk. And so that's an issue. You know, they each played on some good teams, but they didn't have that. Especially, I don't want to talk about the non-NBA stuff, because that is a factor here. Kobe and Dirk had better international careers, but I would go KG, Dirk, Kobe on just the NBA.
Yeah, I think like Kobe just being like kind of a miserable teammate is something that's kind of moves the needle for me as well on this one. And I think both Dirk is probably, everybody loves Dirk. No one has ever had a bad thing to say about him. KG, a little bit prickly and intense, but certainly another guy that people really like respected his intensity and preparation, and was known as a great teammate also. And those Wolves teams really were some excellent teams offensively, at least until Flip Saunders ended up leaving. So maybe KG is being underrated as an offensive player, but by this analysis, I mean, the only problem with KG is just that he was basically done as a superstar by like age 31, which is, and Dirk and Kobe went on a little bit longer than that. Although Kobe was kind of done at 34, like Dirk's longevity maybe even is a little bit better than Kobe's.
Kobe, we talked about 06, 07. Kobe didn't have a PER over 14.5 after that season. I mean, he was around, but he wasn't doing that. 24, and I care substantially.
24.5.
Yeah, 24.5, sorry. But the idea for me is that I care more about prime than about longevity. I mean, longevity certainly helps. It's more, for me, more of a tiebreaker, but there are different reasonable opinions on that subject.
Rhinoceroses. What is going on with the Wolves? What would you look to right the ship towards their preseason expectations? And what would you do to do that? Or would you embrace another losing season and a high lottery pick?
I'm not exactly sure what that means for them, because they're playing young guys either way. This isn't a team that has to fundamentally restructure. I wouldn't trade future assets to get better this year unless it's, you know, a mistake trade for the other team. But the other part of it is I would play Tyus Jones and Chris Dunn together a little bit more and things like that. That might help in both capacities. But I would listen on everyone other than Towns on this team, and I'm not sure that the Wolves are going to do that.
Yeah, by the way, I'm not on board with this Chris Dunn off the ball thing that you
I know
that you've been putting there, but
we don't have to agree.
I was now totally distracted by that. So I think the only reason that you would want to make sure you try and win more this year is just to like look a little bit better in free agency this summer. And that, to me, I don't think it's going to happen either. I don't mind them getting another draft pick. They need another wing or a decent four on this team. I don't think that Jang is that guy. The way that they've played so far this year to me shows why it was a mistake to extend Jang, both because the individual's performance and the way that he fits in with the way that they've played so far this year. I don't think he would have gotten some massive offer on the market, especially because I think it's going to be a worse market. I think basically you just have to hope that you defend better and try to find out maybe more of what you have in Shabazz Muhammad and Chris Dunn. We of course would like to see them with more Wiggins or Shabazz, a power forward, Bielitsa as well, maybe try to give him a little bit more with the ball in his hands, more Towns at center, do some more switching, but they also need to play conventionally. I mean, I think Tibbs is taking the long view in terms of, you know, based on some of his quotes about, hey, we were 29 wins last year, we got a long way to go defensively, and they are a little bit better than they were last year. At least they're not just like complete tire fire the way they were as just like one of the worst teams in the league. Now they're at least like respectable NBA defense. But I'm not sure. Yeah, I mean, I think it's basically kind of stay the course, try to experiment a little bit, find out more what you have in the young guys, but that's about all you can really do. They have young guys. Maybe you explore the market for Rubio and see what's out there for him, but other than that, I mean, I think if you had to pick, I would say, you know, let's just embrace another losing season over let's try to like get back in it. Cause I think that ship has probably sailed at this point at 6-16 as they are.
I got mad again about the Jang extension last night when they were playing the Raptors, and just didn't like, they don't have that many options to really try different stuff. And it's like, well, if you need more flexibility, the best way to do that is to not commit to a player who it's not completely sure that they're worth it.
Easy one here. Deets 241. When we'll see the top 10 prospects pod, and will you be accompanying it with some written words? Will it just be in podcast form? Nobody pays me to write right now, so everything is in podcast form, and the economics for podcasting is much better than writing. We probably will have that within the next week or two. I started the research on it already. SWR Sword Damocles, but the D is the last D in sword and the first D in Damocles at the same time. How are the Pistons such a good defensive team with Andre Drummond acting more as a defensive flotation device than a defensive anchor? I'm not really sure that he's been that bad so far this year, but you looked into this a little bit more. I haven't watched as much Pistons with Reggie Jackson out. I'm going to start locking in on them more. So I would say I did not have a great answer for this other than just that Stan Van Gundy is a good coach and KCP is fantastic guarding one of the best players on the other team on the wing.
That is a key part of the answer from what I know. I've probably watched a little bit more than you, but not a ton. And the biggest answer statistically, since you have to rely on that when you don't have much in the eye test, is that their bench is killing it defensively. They have a 93.4 defensive rating when Drummond's not playing. 105.
Yeah, I think that's what he was talking about, huh?
So like, but a lot of that is also just they're pretty deep, especially at the big man spots. Aaron Baines is a pretty solid backup center. They have a lot of guys who try. They have guys who try, and effort is important there. Also, they're opposing shooting when Drummond is off the floor is completely unsustainable. They've given up 26.3% shooting on threes with a higher attempt rate when Drummond's off. That's not going to continue.
Yeah. All right. So I think it seems like a lot of it may just kind of be good and bad luck in those situations when he's either off the court or on, respectively. Mayo for life. In evaluating players you guys still use, albeit always in a qualified way, stats like PER and real plus minus, which still give weight to traditional box score counting statistics, is there any solid empirical basis for our use of these counting statistics in player evaluations? And yes, that's correct. That's why RPM does have a box score prior. Basically, for those who don't understand, RPM purports to measure the impact when a player is on or off the court, adjusting for both his own teammates and the opposition at the particular times that he's played. However, there are just so many sample size issues with a pure RPM, which is known as RAPM, regularized adjusted plus minus, that, because, you know, think about it, how many minutes are you playing without a certain player on the team, right? Chris Paul and Blake Griffin, how many minutes to each of them play without one another that you can separate them out, collinearity, I think it is the term for it, that it's very difficult to separate. So you can take some of those small samples, and then you also have an idea of what box score stats correlate with how good you make your team when you're on and off the court. And so those can be used to give a little bit more certainty when the sample size is so small. You really need about 3 years of RPM data that you can like to get the noise out of it when you're just only talking, or RAPM data when you're only talking about the on-off. So, and then you can also point to the fact that box score stats correlate with winning quite well. Maybe not quite as well as some of the on-off metrics, but I think it's been shown that RPM, which includes the box score stats, does a little bit better job of predicting than just pure RAPM does. So I think that that's the reason I'm not an absolute expert on this. I'm not doing ridge regressions to figure out what everyone's regularized adjusted plus minus is. That's beyond my capabilities. But from everything that I've read, that's the best explanation that I can give you.
I don't really have much to say on that, so I'll move on to the next question, which is from Charlotte's Webster. If you were running a team, would you only aim for a championship, or would you be content with a consistent 50-win team that may make the second round? My answer is it depends entirely on context. You have to be honest about what you are and what you can be in order to determine what you should be.
Yeah, I don't know where we've said this before, but if you're Stan Van Gundy, you inherit a team without any top five picks. Andre Drummond is really your best guy. He's done a great job to get them into looking like, you know, they're going to be a high 40s win team maybe this year or even even if they're mid 40s, but all their guys are young, pretty much, that are important, they could probably going to be a low 50s win team for a time here. And given where they started, they would have had to basically endure like 2 or 3 years of pain to get some high draft picks to get superstar potential. They weren't in the running for the absolute best free agents, or at least perceived themselves not to be. They're probably right about that. So I think he's done well, even if you would be hard pressed to find championship upside with this team. If you're New Orleans and you just got Anthony Davis, now you say, hey, we're going to try to get a second star. If you're Sacramento and you have DeMarcus Cousins, we got a star. Let's try and get a second one. Let's orient in that direction. So, you know, if you're Charlotte, you know, maybe they're not the best example because I think they had some chances to go for some more upside in the draft and didn't necessarily take it. But I think that that is certainly, I think with the draft, I would be more along when you have high picks, I'd be more along the lines of trying to aim for championships, aim high, because you just only get so many chances at those players. But if you don't have a high draft pick and you don't have the chance of getting a superstar in free agency, then I think doing what you can, getting to be a consistent winner is a totally fine goal.
And in the converse, if you are a desirable free agent destination, I feel like unless you have a great team, you have to use that to your advantage. That's why I've annihilated the Knicks and the Nets and the Lakers for so many years. And because they haven't embraced their competitive advantage, we will have gone through an entire CBA where they didn't really do that, where they didn't use the advantages due to the extension system that they had. Whereas a team like Miami did, and the Warriors did by circumstance too, but they're not a major market. They're not a free agent destination the same way.
Let's do two more here since we're running pretty long. Martavis, how much do you buy into this year being considered a strong draft at this early stage? Like, how much would you value a top 10 pick this year relative to last year, which is considered a weak draft? I think it is, especially at this point in the year, as opposed to right around the time of the draft, foolish to put too much stock in that kind of stuff. I mean, if you look at, for example, the 2012 draft was considered it was going to be pretty good. And then basically all of those guys disappointed. I think, you know, that was like the Perry Jones year, I think. 2014 was supposed to be an all-timer. It really disappointed in part due to injuries. Some of those guys are looking better this year, but still not looking like it's going to be one of the greatest drafts ever. 2015, no one was talking about that as being that good, and that's looking like it's going to be amazing. 07, everyone was like, this is the greatest draft ever, and really, you know, in terms of superstars, Kevin Durant was the only one to come out of that draft. Maybe Odin was taken from us, but maybe he would have been one. But and then 08, no one ever talked about. 09, no one ever talked about. And those, I mean, the top end talent in those drafts was unbelievable. So it's really hard to tell at this point in time. And I mean, the 09 draft, Steph Curry was okay, kind of got in the rookie of the year conversation. Everyone was saying it was Tyreek Evans was the best player. He was the rookie of the year. James Harden did nothing. He was looking like a bust after the first year. Blake Griffin missed the entire first year due to injury. So even after a year, it's difficult to say. I mean, I will say that the 2016 draft is not looking like a particularly good one so far, but with Jamal Murray and really looking like the best guy to play so far out of that draft at number seven, Embiid was 2014, obviously. You know, Simmons hasn't played at all yet. So it's hard to say. I'm not going to go crazy on like, oh, this is a good draft, this is a bad draft, because I think it's one of those things where the data has shown that that's not something, especially a year before the draft, that you can really predict accurately.
It's also important to note that a lot of these players are in dramatically different situations, which are better representations of what they're going to be. You know, a player can look really good in high school in AAU, but then when they're in college, it can look different. And so you have to piece all of that together. And since so many guys in this class are freshmen, they're dealing with a lot of other adjustments, both on and off the court. And it becomes hard to make a read early. But I also do trust that there are people, especially now, who have scouted these guys for such a long time that they have a better sense than maybe we did back then.
Last one, John Dwayne Casey, which teams could benefit the most from a tactical shift? And I think he's leaving more, the way I'm going to interpret it is not necessarily just player usage, although that's something that's going to play in with strategy a lot, you know, where if you're not playing two bigs and you're the Wolves, that kind of thing, you're going to use a little bit different strategy offensively and defensively. You're going to switch more. You're going to probably do more spread pick and roll, that kind of stuff. But I think if you're just looking from a purely tactical perspective, what stands out to you, Danny?
I would love to see the Knicks use Porzingis more. I think that's a really clear one. And one that I've been thinking about, especially watching them last night, granted, not a representative sample, but I'd like to see the guys who can run on the Jazz run a little bit more. You can play slow the rest of the time, but give yourself more chances in transition. They're second from last in transition frequency and second in transition points per possession.
Yeah, and they have one of the most efficient offenses, or at least they're a top 10 offense, even with all the injuries, even without running. So it might be better to see that. It'd be interesting to see. You know, there are certain units they could put together, I think, there. But George Hill, for all of his gifts so far this year, not really a push it in transition guy as point guard. Same thing with Mac. And you know, most wings are not going to just like run it down your throat necessarily, unless you're like a LeBron or Draymond Green, that kind of guy. The Wolves switching more is one that we talked about. I think for the Bucks, I'd like to see a little bit more switching from them too. I'm kind of violating my own rule here by saying that they should spread the floor a little bit more, give us some more Mirza. The two that really popped out to me are the Raptors moving the ball more, and not only even moving the ball more, but just getting into their offense faster, especially late games. If you look at some of the film from that Pacers series, from that Miami series last year, when their offense was just so terrible late in games, they were just like holding the ball and not even running the first action until there's 10 seconds left on the shot clock. And that's just inexcusable. That's something that's very easy to fix. It's just, okay, go faster. You know, like that's not moving the ball. Yeah, that might be a little more difficult. They do have some good isolation guys, but even then you can get someone like DeRozan the ball on the move a little bit more, be a little bit less stagnant. Probably too late to implement that at this point, but at least like getting into the offense faster. I mean, and that's a ton of teams. Just like there's no time you should ever be like making your first pass or running your first screen with 12 seconds left on the shot clock. And then Oklahoma City, I think, could really benefit from just slowing the pace down when Russell Westbrook is out of the game, because they're going to get killed during those minutes. So at least make it less possessions. All right, we done here?
Yeah, I think so.
All right, thanks so much for listening. Don't forget about our sponsor today, Movement Watches, mvmtwatches.com/capspace. Check it out for your holiday gift buying. You can get 15% off using that Capspace URL. Then Indochino, use that Capspace code to get any premium suit for $389 at indochino.com. Love those suits. We were just talking yesterday about how they just fit so much better than the normal suits that both of us have. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. A reminder that the Twitter NBA show will actually be Tuesday of next week. We got great numbers. Thank you so much to everyone who watched. We actually were over 50,000 on the post-game show and been trending upward there. So it looks like it's kind of taking off. And if you want an alternative to the normal Talking Head studio show, please give us a listen or just check it out if you missed the game also. We're going to play around with the idea of making that a podcast as well, and maybe posting it the next day and adding on like a little bit of content to it. But tweet me and let me know kind of what you think would be good for us to do with that. We also don't want to cannibalize the numbers from the Twitter show too much either. So we'll play around with it and kind of see where we're at on that. I know that for some people, if you're on your commute next day, like the Periscope is not necessarily the most convenient format to listen to it. All right, now we are done here. Talk to you all for Eastern Conference 15 and 60 Sunday night. Till then.